morning. Please be seated. First case on calendar this morning is the matter of Hidalgo versus State. Counsel is ready to proceed. If you wish to reserve any time, please state how much time you wish to reserve.
I'd like to preserve 5 minutes, but we'll see what happens.
Please proceed.
I found that usually my guesses are in vain, but we'll see how it goes. Anyway, if it pleases the court, my name is Richard Cornell. I'm counsel for Luis Hidalgo III, who in these proceedings has been known as Little Lou. And I want to start by making two basic points. First, it's unusual for me to have oral argument. This, of the numerous post-conviction appeals that I've handled, I think this is only the third one in 36 years where it's been ordered to appear for oral argument.
It's because there's a new sheriff in town.
Well, that may be the reason. I don't know. The way I looked at it, the reason that this might have happened besides the new sheriff is it's really, from my client's perspective, an unusual case. My client, Little Lou, is serving 10 to life times 2 for second-degree murder and abuse of a deadly weapon for a murder that we know he did not commit, a murder where we know from the record, we have no evidence otherwise, that he never met the murderer, Mr. Counts. We know from the record that he said plenty, including statements about bats and bags from which, viewed in the light most favorable state, we can infer an intent to kill, but we know that what he said, or what was attributed to him, was ignored by his co-conspirators. At the end of the day, we know from looking at the record that nobody amongst the so-called co-conspirators agreed to beat Mr. Hadlin with a baseball bat, and we know from reviewing the record that Mr. Little Lou never agreed to shoot Hadlin. So, from my perspective, to be honest with you, I call that an injustice, but I know the problem I have, which is, if it's an injustice, it was just as much an injustice when the case was here in direct appeal, and yet it was affirmed. The bigger problem I have, I know, is that in post-conviction, if I have a case where I say it's an injustice, I'm in the position of blaming the lawyer. And in this case, John R. Scott is not only a dear friend of mine, he's a great lawyer. He's a lawyer who enjoys a wonderful reputation in our part of the state, really in the whole state, and he's very highly respected, and he did a lot of really good things in this case. But Pellegrini directs us that when we have this kind of case, we're forced to think about blaming the lawyer. So when I got this record and wrapped my mind around what the case was all about from Little Lou's perspective and said, what's the problem with the lawyer? I concluded it wasn't how he presented the case. It wasn't witnesses that he should have presented but didn't. It wasn't evidence that he should have objected to but didn't. It wasn't any of that. It had to do with the jury instructions. Can jury instructions form the basis of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim? The answer is certainly. I cited a number of cases in the standard review, pages 28 and 32, particularly the Ninth Circuit case of Langford Arrave versus Arrave, that shows how that can happen. That's why my standard review was so long. But when we have a case of jury instructions that lower the burden of proof and make it easier for the state to get a conviction, or we have a lack of jury or case instructions, those we can pin the blame on the lawyer. That actually even is IAC in the most basic short. And as I thought about it, I thought, you know, the problem is, and you know from when you tried cases, in most trials, in many trials, trial lawyers don't think too awfully hard about the jury instructions because the charge and the defense are usually pretty straightforward. But when you have a case of a defendant who has done nothing to cause the death of the victim and has said a lot, but has said a lot of stuff that was ignored evidently, what should those jury instructions look like? Because the state is trying to take away his liberty for the rest of his life on a second-degree murder theory based on a conspiracy theory. What should the instructions look like?
Is that the only error that you're claiming as far as jury instructions is concerned, as far as trial counsel?
We also have the two severance grounds, and frankly, I wasn't planning to talk about those today, although if you want me to,
I could kind of back up and go a little more into detail into the first one, which you were speaking of. You seem to be relying upon California law. Why should we look at that law opposed to where Nevada is? Because there is a distinction.
Well, you're talking about what I would call Issue 3A, or the Home versus Carry issue, as I call it, the Ninth Circuit case, it's because California law, as I see it, which is what the Ninth Circuit ultimately looked to in granting habeas for Mr. Ho, is not different from Nevada. We can have as many jury instructions given as we want, but in this case, when we have not one but two, instructions 19 and 22, not merely not objected to by defense lawyers, but ones that defense lawyers helped craft, that advise that second-degree murder can be based on a conspiracy theory and liability can intend based on general intent and reasonable foreseeability without further defining by whom, but that's not the problem. But when they say that without any mention of malice, that's a huge problem. California is not different from Nevada in that regard. By statute, 200.020, we require a finding of malice in all murder prosecutions, regardless of what the theory is. And when you have instructions, not one, but two, that talk about defining second-degree murder without talking about malice, it allows the jury to focus on those instructions, ignore others, and as this court has often said, jurors can't be expected to be legal experts on points of law. And when it happens twice, I submit to you that in that case, Ho versus Carey really is on all fours and really is awfully persuasive authority, given that it is the Ninth Circuit that ultimately has jurisdiction over all of this.
Did Ellis kind of testify at the evidentiary hearing?
He did.
Did he admit he was ineffective?
He said on the jury instructions that the record simply is going to speak for itself in terms of what he objected to or crafted and didn't object to.
Did you press him at all on that?
No, because Judge Adair made it clear that she didn't want an evidentiary hearing on that issue or on those issues. What she really wanted was the evidentiary hearing on the severance issues. And he did testify in that, and he did admit that when the record came up and he really needed to get Toyapu's testimony in to rebut the issue of who made the statement about the bats and bags, he should have sought a severance at that point.
So he admitted he was ineffective?
On that issue. That's what he did say. But as again, I wasn't planning to talk about that. I didn't quite honestly think that was my best issue because of how this court ruled.
But if the trial lawyer gets on the stand, and in those types of situations, and believe me, I've been there before as a trial lawyer, and using the DA makes you sound like you walk on water to make you, the record see that you weren't ineffective, that's why the issue is so important under Strickland, that somebody's ineffective. Now, under the second prong, was it prejudicial?
Sure.
And he admitted it was prejudicial also?
I don't know that a lawyer can do that competently. I think that's purely a call of the district court judge. And the district court judge had an easy way to go on that, which is, at its heart, I'm complaining about an issue that he raised on direct appeal that the court rejected, which is he had a Sixth Amendment right to have Toyapu's prior sworn testimony in, and I talked a lot about that in the briefs. And like I said, I wasn't intending to argue that today, but in any case, that was, to answer your question, that's what he testified about. But on jury instructions, and the record shows what it shows, what we don't have, and this is issue 3B, is what I would call a Sheriff versus Morris or a La Bastida instruction, which is that to be guilty of second-degree murder, you have to be a direct immediate proximate cause or direct proximate cause of the death. And the argument I would sense against that is, first thing you're saying, you're asking about a Ramirez instruction, and Ramirez postdates this trial, to which I say, sure, Ramirez is not a new rule. It's based on La Bastida and Morris, which are 10, 20 years prior to this case. I would expect the argument to be, those come out of the issues of felony second-degree murder. My response to that is, yes, in felony second-degree murder is a judge-made rule to find a compact way to get to second-degree murder. Conspiracy theory is the same thing. It doesn't change the statutes. It can't change the statutes. The courts cannot and do not act as super legislatures. With both felony second-degree murder and with conspiracy under Bolden, these are ways to get to the bottom line of second-degree murder. But second-degree murder always requires an immediate direct cause in fact and proximate cause relation between the act of the defendant and the death. And that was their theory of the case, that, wait a minute, Little Lou did nothing to cause Hadlin's death, and what he said was ignored. If that's so, why in the world not have a jury instruction that instructs the jury, and it would be easy to do. It wouldn't be Ramirez. It would be La Bastida, and it would be Sheriff versus Morris. And the other comment that I'll make on the second issue, this is the one that Mr. Ariscotta litigated heavily, which was the McDowell issue, or what I call the A1D2E issue on when and how juries consider out-of-court statements. He made the argument that the language of slight evidence is mixing up what the trial judge does in letting the evidence in versus what the jury does in assessing it. And it was a good argument. In fact, there's a Second Circuit case on point. But my argument is there's two reasons why that instruction was bad, instruction number 40. And the second one is based on the federal cases of Padilla, Clark, and Gordon. You can admit the statements, but the jury has to know that in order to give them any weight, there has to be acts that back the statements. In this case, the whole basis of liability on Little Lou is based on what he said. If the jury gets that instruction and says, wait a minute, we have to look at what he did that corroborates what he supposedly said, we got a problem finding him guilty, because there are no bats and bags in this case. There are no violent acts in the nature of Rizzolo and Gallardi. There's nothing that corroborates what he supposedly said. And what did he supposedly say? It came out of the mouth of a co-conspirator who didn't testify. D'Angelo Carroll, a witness who everybody describes as unreliable. I mean, I invite you to relook at pages 24 through 26 of the opening brief. It goes in detail of how unreliable he is. If the jury gets that instruction and they say, what did he do in furtherance of the conspiracy? Nothing. Then it gets ignored, and without that, there's no evidence. Now, I was going to talk on the first issue, the Moore versus State issue, just on the deadly weapon enhancement. I see, sure enough, I've got 2.5 minutes left to go, so I'll reserve.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Counsel?
Good morning, Justices. My name is John Carlo Pesci. I'm here on behalf of the State of Nevada. At the outset, I wanted to point out that speaking with counsel before we came in, I commented on how I thought he professionally pointed to the faults that occurred at the trial level or the appeals level without vilifying the defense attorneys, and I thought that was commendable. I wish that that was what happened more often. But there were, in fact, commendable attorneys, both at the trial level and at the appeals level. I want to get back to that, but I want to start off with a statement we just heard, was that it was what D'Angelo Carroll said that implicated Mr. H. That's partially accurate, but what we have to remember is it's actually what the appellant said, not what Mr. Carroll said. It was the appellant who specifically said to Mr. Carroll, I told you, you should take care of TJ. That was a recording. That was straight from the appellant's mouth. That's not what a non-available co-conspirator said. It was said to the unavailable co-conspirator. That cannot be forgotten when we look at what it was that appellant did. And in addition to that, what the appellant did and was pointed out actually in affirmance by this court, and two of you justices in particular, the appellant was present during a conversation in which Mr. H, the owner, was told about the victim, TJ, speaking ill of the club. That testimony came in from a testifying witness, a co-conspirator, but a testifying witness, Ms. Annabelle Espindola. She was subject to cross-examination. She showed that it was the appellant who said to his father that he needed to take action. He needed to do something. These are the actions and the statements of the appellant. This is the order that went out and was carried out by the doorman, Mr. Carroll, and then the individual that he found, Mr. Counts. They also have, we presented evidence of phone calls from the appellant to D'Angelo Carroll before the murder and after the murder. This, again, is evidence that came in separate and distinct from D'Angelo Carroll. We also have the recordings that I just highlighted one portion of. The recordings themselves show what it was or what part the appellant played in this whole process, because when there was the recording with the appellant and D'Angelo Carroll and Annabelle Espindola, and D'Angelo Carroll was coming in saying that the witnesses, Ronte Zone and Jason Taipo, needed money to be quiet, it was the appellant who suggested killing the witnesses. Now, of course, that's not the murder of T.J. Hamlin, but that information can be taken into consideration when it's looked at in the context of the murder itself.
This argument seems to go to his guilt, but what about the jury instructions and the Moore issue about the deadly weapon and the severance? What about those issues, Mr. President?
As to the deadly weapon, we're not arguing whether we seek for an enhancement on the conspiracy charge. This court has already determined that there is no such thing. That did not occur here. We use the conspiracy as a theory of criminal liability. What we have is an individual who is a part of the decision process to give the order to kill this individual, and that he set into action a plan. There was plan A and there was plan B. Plan B was to beat. Plan A was to kill. So we have an individual who set this in course. And so he has to be on the hook for those actions. Now, if you're concerned, obviously, that there could be some sort of conviction that didn't properly apply, jury instruction 19, which was referenced by defense counsel or appellant counsel, I apologize, and appellant counsel talked about how appellate trial attorney specifically was a part of the process of creating this instruction. They fought hard for these instructions. It specifically delineates between murder of the first degree and murder of the second degree. And that if you're going to come to a conclusion of murder of the second degree, there is a different standard. And that's at 11 Appellate Appendix 2630. And it explained how you had to have a different standard in the evidence. It talks about murder in the first degree is a specific intent crime. And then it went through murder in the second degree is a general intent crime. And then it had to be those acts committed by co-conspirators that were reasonably foreseeable, probable, and natural consequences. They clearly are, because it was this appellant and his father who comprised or came up with plan A, kill, and plan B, beat. He cannot say it's not reasonably foreseeable for him to have thought that they would actually kill him, because that was one of the plans. And this was based on an analysis, as I heard it, of Ho v. Carey, which comes out of California. Now, factually, that situation was far different from ours. In that case, during the settlement of instructions or the presentation of instructions, on one day, one instruction was given. The subsequent day, a second instruction was given, dealing with this first versus second. And the concern was that the jury wouldn't understand how to apply each. That's not what happened here. We didn't have 2 days of instruction. And we specifically had one instruction, again, balance 2651, that specifically went through first versus second. There's no confusion here. There's no concern of confusion. And there's no concern of unintended consequences for someone who gets swooped into the conspiracy. Appellant's a part of the hub of the conspiracy that gets sent out via the spokes to the rear. He didn't get pulled in some sort of a net. So those concerns do not apply in this particular situation. And when it comes to the instruction on conspiracy, this court already on direct appeal has found that jury instruction 40, dealing with the slight evidence of a conspiracy, was appropriate. And again, if there was a concern because somehow there's a different argument here about how somebody could be pulled in, that's not the case here. That's not what happened with these individuals, with this appellant in particular. I mean, that could be applied maybe to Jason Taipa, but this is not the person who we had before. We have the appellant. And so there's no concern there. Now, going to Mr.
But your contention is that the proper instructions on conspiracy as to co-conspirator statements and the fact that you need cooperation of the conspiracy to convict somebody, that was adequately covered by the jury instructions.
Yes, Your Honor.
And did Mr. Arascata say that he felt that he was ineffective for not doing something more with the jury instructions?
Justice, I apologize. I don't know the specific question to that tailored question.
Uh-huh.
But as far as what you brought up earlier, as far as Mr. Arascata saying he was ineffective or not, and I mean this respectfully, I don't think we go on what the defense attorney says. As you said earlier, the state's going to try to make the defense attorney look perfect. It's up to the judge. The district court made a decision, and then you determined if that decision was appropriate. And let's look at the context of that, as far as what is perceived as Mr. Arascada saying he was ineffective. I take issue with that, because Mr. Arascada, along with Mr. Gentile, effectively prevented the death penalty from going forward in this case, negotiated that away so that severance would be a part of that. No severance, no death penalty. So the state got its portion. We got to keep them together. The defendant got his portion. I don't know of a more effective thing to do as a defense attorney, especially a trial attorney, than to take the death penalty off the table. And that was the negotiation Mr. Arascada was very, very much a part of. And then, as far as Mr. Tayupu, and I apologize, because I think your second question as far as Mr. Arascada was asked to Mr. Tayupu. Mr. Arascada fought tooth and nail to get in Mr. Tayupu's statement. So we cannot say that it was, in fact, ineffective assistance. This court, specifically on the direct affirmance, said that the district court properly excluded that testimony. So you would, in essence, have to be saying that you were wrong, not that Mr. Arascada was ineffective. He effectively tried, was not successful, but his lack of success was upheld by this court. So I respectfully, I don't think it hinges on what Mr. Arascada says. And with that, unless there are any other questions, I'll submit.
Nothing.
Any additional questions?
No.
Thank you.
I do want to make a couple things clear to the extent I already haven't. We are not challenging the solicitation of murder counts that happened after the fact. In fact, the only challenge we have is they should have had separate trials on that versus the murder. They got him on tape. They got him saying what he says regarding Toiafo and Zone. If he said the statements with that intent, it's over. It doesn't matter whether anybody acted on him. But the important thing about that, I think, is who is he acting for? He's acting for his father. You know, his father's the one paying the hush money and so forth. The testimony, the recorded testimony, also has Carol saying to Little Lou, what are you worried about? You had nothing to do with this, right? And there's also conflicting evidence on what Plan A and Plan B means. The testimony, the trial testimony of Pilar Hanley, the fellow who worked there, said Plan A and Plan B has to do with how they compensate the taxi cab drivers for bringing the customers to the Palomino Club. That's all that it means. With respect to the Moore issue, since it was brought up, I want to be sure we're very clear. We're not talking about an instruction that defines second-degree murder. We're talking about instruction on when it's appropriate to put the deadly weapon enhancement on murder. And, of course, Moore says that conspiracy that doesn't involve the use of a deadly weapon, you can't enhance because the conspiracy is completed when the agreement's reached. We don't look to overt acts. The response of the state is, yeah, but we didn't charge him with conspiracy. That was
but in this case, the deadly weapon sounds like he's part of the, because he's a principal to the murder rather than a conspirator.
Right.
Principal.
That's my point, that in order for the deadly weapon enhancement to work in a conspiracy theory case, the conspiracy itself would have to involve the use of a deadly weapon, which would be like an active participant. In this case, if he's talking about bats and bags, if we credit that conflicting testimony, we know there was no bats used in this case. If we're talking about shooting him, we know there's no evidence before the fact that he agreed to that. And I told you to take care of him. I told you to go to Plan B. I told you to hit him, not to kill him. I mean, clearly no evidence that would warrant a deadly weapon enhancement. And this is one where I think it's clear enough to where a 175-291 motion would have been appropriate post-jury, even if not for jury instruction. So with that, I submit it, and I thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. We thank Counsel for your arguments this day. This matter will stand submitted at this time.